We're going to return to our study in Joshua, continuing now in chapters 9 and 10. Let's start with a moment of prayer before we begin our Sunday school. Father, we thank you for this morning, for this time that we can be here. We thank you for Joshua and the magnificent man that he is, that he was, and that looking at his life, looking at the decisions he's made, the leadership he provided, that we can see some amazing qualities, some virtues that we might aspire to. Father, we thank you that through your word we can come to understand who you are, and in doing that to develop our relationship with you better. We come to you in your son's name. Amen. So starting Joshua chapter 9, verses 1 to 6, and the pace is going to stay pretty rapid this morning, just because we have a lot to cover. Now it came about when all the kings who were beyond the Jordan, in the hill country, in the lowland, and on all the coasts of the great sea toward Lebanon, and the Hittite, the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite, and yes, this should sound familiar, Colby, heard of it. They gathered themselves together with one accord to fight with Joshua and with Israel. When the inhabitants of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done to Jericho and to Ai, they also acted craftily and set out as envoys, and took worn-out sacks on their donkeys, and wineskins worn out and torn and mended, and worn-out and patched sandals on their feet, and worn-out clothes on themselves, and all the bread of their provision was dry and had become crumbled. And then they went to Joshua and to the camp at Gilgal, and said to him and to the men of Israel, "We have come from a far country, and now therefore make a covenant with us." So now, before we even get started on this, we have to go back, and I'm going to ask Colby and Laura, can you tell me, how did the land of Canaan come by that name? I know it's been 6 days. And 6 days is a long time. Well, while they're pondering that deep, mysterious truth, can someone look up Genesis chapter 9, verses 15 to 19? Genesis chapter 10, verses 15 to 19. It's 10. I think I said 9 before because we're in Joshua 9, but it's actually Genesis 10. Genesis 10, 15 and 19. Gray?
Canaan became the father of Sidon, his firstborn, and Heth, and the Jebusite, and the Amorite, and the Girgashite, and the Hivite, and the Arkite, and the Sinite, and the Arvadite, and the Zamorite, and the Hamathite.
Go ahead and verse 19 also.
The territory of the Canaanite extended from Sidon as you go toward Gerar, as far as Gaza, as you go toward Sodom and Gomorrah, and Admah and Zeboim, as far as Lasha.
Does that sound familiar now, Laura? Did we hear that maybe on Monday? All right. So how did Canaan, the land of Canaan, get its name? Sort of, but where does it come from?
Are you looking for a root source?
Yes, I'm looking for a root source.
Oh, son of Ham.
This is from the son of Ham. All right, this goes all the way back to Noah. And so what we're going to be looking at here in Joshua, what we have been seeing, this is all historically goes back to the curse on Ham. Now, does this sound familiar? We did just talk about this this past week in Awana. Right, this goes back to the curse on Ham. And so this land that God has given to the Israelites, he is taking away from the descendants of Ham. Right, from the descendants of Ham's son, Canaan. Right, and so this is named after Canaan, son of Ham, because it's all his extended family that is possessing the land. Right, so as we look at what's going on here, this has its roots in that curse as much as it does the blessing in Abraham. Right, so there's two sides to this that are going on. And we have these lists of names. All right, and then would someone else read Exodus 23, verses 23 and 24? Exodus 23 and 24.
For my angel will go before you and bring you into the Amorites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Canaanites and the Hivites and the Jebusites, and I will cut them off. You shall not bow down to their gods, nor serve them, nor do according to their works, but you shall utterly overthrow them and completely break down their sacred pillars.
All right, so here we've got the very same names that we saw back in the lineage of Ham. This is their land. God says, I'm going to take you into their land. I'm going to wipe them out, and you're going to be the instrument I do it. Right. Don't keep their stuff. Right. Don't worship their gods. Don't serve them. Don't act like them. You're going to destroy them. You're going to destroy their false gods. Right. So this is about their idolatry, their lifestyles. Everything about them is wholly evil. So don't be like them. Get rid of them. And so then we get into our passage here in Joshua 9. We get to this list, and we see that same list. And they've gathered themselves together to fight against Joshua. Right? If they don't do it, if they don't make a coalition of defenders here, Joshua's going to chew them up piecemeal. So they band together. And then we get to verse 2, and we get this, or verse 3, and we get this description of the Gibeonites. Right? And this kind of sets the tone for how we understand what comes. It says, they're crafty, they're sly, right? They're liars, they're deceivers. So everything that follows in here is about deception. They're sneaky. Right? So they give they put together this travel kit. And what are they doing here with this, their provisions for traveling all of 20 miles, 30 miles maybe? What are they doing?
They're laying the groundwork to try to make fool the Israelites that they were outside of the territory. Mm-hmm.
So they're creating the visual picture to support their deception. All right, they're not just going to deceive with their mouths. They're going to deceive with, I mean, they're going to make the whole thing believable. All right, they want to sell it. So now there's another subtle contrast here, though, that's interesting. Anyone else see this contrast? And I'm not really expecting you to. Look through this description of what how they equip themselves. And what does it stand out against? How long have the Israelites been meandering around here, there, and anywhere?
40 years plus.
40 years plus. And what do we know about their shoes and their clothes? And their stuff. Is it? Is their stuff all worn out? Are you pretty sure about that, Colby? You're going to stick with that answer, Laura? Would you like to weigh in on this? You don't know. Okay. Anyone else?
Yeah, their journey, they did not wear out anything. It lasted for the whole journey.
Their shoes never wore out. Their clothes never wore out. And instead of eating crumbly, moldy bread, they had manna from heaven on a daily basis. All right, so here, this description of what these Gibeonites are setting themselves up, this is what travelers who go for a long trip look like. And here are these Israelites looking pretty darn fresh, even though they've been wandering around for a generation. Their stuff is newer than the stuff the Gibeonites bring together in their deception. Okay, so just a little bit of a contrast there.
Right.
They are. All right, they're good at this deception stuff. They've thought it through. Verses 7 to 13. The men of Israel said to the Hivites, "Perhaps you are living within our land. How then shall we make a covenant with you?" But they said to Joshua, "We are your servants." Then Joshua said to them, "Who are you, and where do you come from?" They said to him, "Your servants have come from a very far country because of the fame of the Lord your God. For we have heard the report of him and all that he did in Egypt, and all that he did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon, the king of Heshbon, and to Og, the king of Bashan, who was in Ashtaroth. So our elders and all the inhabitants of our country spoke to us, saying, 'Take provisions in your hand for the journey and go to meet them and say to them, we are your servants. Now then, make a covenant with us.'" So here we, as part of this setting, we find out that these Gibeonites are part of the Hivite clan. Right? Gibeonites, that's the city they live in. But the can't quite call a nationality, but the clan they're from, the family line that they're from, they're Hivites. Not that that really means a whole lot other than the fact that that's one of the groups that God says get rid of. And they're part of them. But that their request here reminds us of Exodus 34:12. "Watch yourself that you make no covenant with the inhabitants of the land into which you are going, or it will become a snare in your midst." Or Deuteronomy, Kobe, would you read Deuteronomy 20, verses 15 to 18? Deuteronomy, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. All right. Chapter 20. It's one after 19 before 21. All right. Verses 15 to 18.
"This is how you are to treat all the cities that you are distant from. You and do not be along to the nations nearby. However, in the cities of the nations the Lord your God has given you, and the inherent, do not leave alive anything that breathes. Completely destroy them, the Hittites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Havites, and the Jebusites. As the Lord your God has commanded you, otherwise they will teach you to follow all the detestable things that they do in worship in their gods, and you will sin against the Lord your God."
So this is what the people are supposed to do. Don't make a covenant. Wipe them out. And do it, because if you don't, they're going to cause problems. They are going to infect you with their worship practices. And their worship practices are horrible. So don't do it. Don't make a covenant. And the people here, they seem to know that there's a potential that this is a falsehood. How do we know you are who you say you are? Right, that's how it starts off. And they say, "Well, we're your servants. We're here to serve you." And this, there's some interesting plays in here in how they talk. It's almost as if they've got some knowledge of the law, some knowledge of the Torah, because here they are asking for treatment that in Deuteronomy it says this is what you can do to the people that are from afar off. You can enslave them, you can pillage them, but the ones that are nearby, the Canaanites, you got to get rid of them. And they're coming here, we're your slaves, we're your servants. We voluntarily subjugate ourselves to you. And we're from afar off. So they're appealing to God's policy on how to handle foreigners from somewhere else. And they're aware of what God's done. Right? They talk about Egypt. They talk about Sihon, Og. Right, those are ones that we looked at back in Numbers. Right, but notice what else they don't say. They don't talk about Jericho. They don't talk about Ai. I think part of selling their deception. They've been on the road. Right? They don't have the news. Right? Because they're from a far off land. But their basic arguments for this covenant then are they're impressed with the God of the Israelites. So this is about the Israelites' gods as they're selling their deception. Right? They're not enemies. So there's no reason for the Israelites to wipe them out. And they desire to serve Israel. Right? Presumably because of the power of Israel's God. So that's their argument. It kind of sounds good if you ignore the fact that they're lying and deceiving. And we're impressed with your God and we just want to serve you because of who your God is. Right? And there's kind of interesting overtones of what Rahab says. Your God, I know what your God's done. I can see what your God's done. You're going to win. Let me become one of you. Let me go with you. So there's in Rahab we see this in truth. In the Gibeonites we see this same language in deception. We get to verse 15. This our bread was warm when we took it for our provisions out of our houses on the day that we left to come to you. But now behold, it is dry and has become crumbled. These wineskins which we filled were new, and behold, they are torn. And these our clothes and our sandals are worn out because of the very long journey. So the men of Israel took some of their provisions and did not ask for counsel of the Lord. Joshua made peace with them and made a covenant with them and let them live. And the leaders of the congregation swore an oath to them. So they sell it. They convince them that they're telling the truth. And we get to verse 14. There's a little bit of disagreement on whether or not the Israelites are looking at their supplies at the age of the food, or whether they're sharing in food as part of this hospitality aspect of a peace treaty. And I'm inclined to look at the hospitality side and say they're sharing food with these Hivites, with these Gibeonites. All right? But either way, we see the significance in the second half. What don't they do? What don't they do, Laura? Hint, it's verse 14. They don't talk to God. They say, what's your take on this, Lord? Do we, don't we? Right? They just do it. So they are deceived. They're led astray. Who is deceived here?
Elders
and Joshua. And? So we've got three parties. We got the congregation who doesn't ask God but takes their food. We've got Joshua who makes a covenant. We've got the leaders who swear an oath. All right, so top to bottom, everybody goes for this. So they all share in the responsibility of what follows. Right, because they're all in this together. Right, and so what have they done then? What have they done? When?
Back prior to this, when they, where was it? They did something.
At Ai. Right. Ai was the last time they didn't talk to God. Well, how did that turn out? Not really good. But they apparently didn't learn their lesson. Right. But what else did they do? What else?
They let him live.
Which is? They broke God's command. He said, don't make a covenant. And what do they do? They turn around and make a covenant. It's going to come back and, well, it bites them, but not quite in the way that we're thinking. You get to 16 and 21. And it came about that at the end of three days after they had made the covenant with them, that they heard that they were neighbors and that they were living within their land. Then the sons of Israel set out and came to their cities on the third day. Now their cities were Gibeon, Shephira, and Beeroth, and Kiriath-Jearim, The sons of Israel did not strike them because the leaders of the congregation had sworn to them by the Lord God of Israel. And the whole congregation grumbled against the leaders. But all the leaders said to the whole congregation, "We have sworn to them by the Lord, the God of Israel. Now we cannot touch them. This we will do to them, even let them live, so that the wrath will not be upon us for the oath which we swore to them." The leaders said to them, "Let them live." So they became hewers of wood and drawers of water for the whole congregation, just as the leaders had spoken to them. Right, so it took 3 days to figure out that they'd made a bad mistake. It's actually not bad turnaround time. Sometimes it takes longer than that to figure out made a poor choice. Now we've got three significant factors here. Anyone want to take a stab at what they are?
Well, my mind is not thinking in our goal lines. My mind is thinking as a human and say, here I found out we've been deceived. This deal we made is now canceled.
Okay. All right. Well, okay. That's part of what I'm looking at. What do the people do?
No, they don't.
They let them live, don't they? Why? Because they swore an oath. This is one of those "I swear to God" situations, which goes back to...
Don't ever swear.
Well, it goes back to the Ten Commandments, and you will not take the Lord's name in vain. Meaning you don't promise God this and then go do that. So they've made an oath to God, which I suspect was part of the Gibeonites' required terminology and intentional there. But they've sworn to God, and now they're presented with a situation, and they choose to keep their oath to God.
We say nowadays, fish are cut bait.
I'm not familiar with that one. So what else do they do?
They're slaves out of them.
Okay, before that. Are they crabby? Grumpy? Who are they grumpy with?
The leaders.
Because those silly leaders took an oath. So what are they conveniently forgetting about 3 days ago? Yeah, they were part of it. All right, but it's more convenient and handy to poke a finger at the leaders and say, "It's your fault. You did this." But that's what they're doing. They're poking at the leader, saying, "This is your fault." But we just saw that no, everybody shares the responsibility here. So we've got the congregation who's unhappy, and we've got the leaders, right? And the leaders say, "Well, we can't break this oath because we'll bring God's wrath on us." And so here then we see this hierarchy of priorities here. It's an interesting bit of ethics, all right? And this is really what ethics is when you've got competing priorities of what's good, what's better. Right? The good thing to do, obey God's command and wipe out the people. The better thing to do is, now that they're in this conflict of commands, they have to keep their oath to God. Even though their oath to God puts them in conflict with God's previous command of don't make the commitment, don't make this covenant. Because if they break their oath to God, God's going to squish them. His wrath will be poured out on them. And they recognize that. So that's two of the three parties. Now we'll get to Joshua, chapter 9, verses 22 to 27. Then Joshua called for them and spoke to them, saying, "Why have you deceived us, saying, 'We are very far from you,' when you are living within our land? Now, therefore, you are cursed, and you shall never cease being slaves, both hewers of wood and drawers of water for the house of my God." So they answered Joshua and said, "Because it was certainly told your servants that the Lord your God had commanded his servant Moses to give you all the land and to destroy all the inhabitants of the land before you. Therefore, we feared greatly for our lives because of you and have done this thing. Now behold, we are in your hands. Do as it seems good and right in your sight to do to us. Thus he did to them and delivered them from the hands of the sons of Israel, and they did not kill them. But Joshua made them that day hewers of wood and drawers of water for the congregation and for the altar of the Lord to this day in the place which he would be in the place which he would choose. Joshua's question, this is probably really unfair of me looking back with 3,000 years worth of hindsight, but his question seemed a little naive. Why'd you do this? Well, duh, because you're going to kill us if we don't. That's what it comes down to. Anyone catch a change in pronouns here? Fun little pronoun play. Why do you say you were from far away when you're living in our land? This is our land. You just happen to be on it. We haven't conquered it yet, but it's our land. Right? And he's right. God's already given it to them. But it's an interesting little pronoun there. Joshua already sees the land as their possession because God's given it to them. So they somehow have the gist of God's command to Israel. He says, we've heard this. I don't know how they heard it, but they know. Right? God's already told them, this is what you're to do, and look what happened in Jericho. Look what happened to Ai. So these guys, we got to do what we can while we can.
Where's Balaam in all this?
Time-wise, Balaam is quite a few years prior. Yes.
So
yeah, I don't know. I mean, Balaam.
He's
a generation before.
But everybody heard what Balaam prophesied.
Yeah, that may go back to Balaam. I don't know. So they throw themselves on the integrity of the Israelites. And they say, "Do what is good and right in your eyes." Right? So will they honor their peace treaty or that they've sworn before the Lord, or do they destroy them as God's commanded them, right, and bring on this curse for shedding what then would be in essence innocent blood because they're in a covenant with them, right? And Joshua and the people choose this middle ground. Right? They let them live, but they subjugate them, and so they honor their command to the Lord or their vow to the Lord. But this does something. What does it do in this particular choice of how they're going to deal with them? It does something really important. How do they serve Israel?
They become the servants of the altar of the tabernacle.
Of the tabernacle. So they serve and they facilitate Israelite worship, which means they will be in daily contact with the priests, the Levites. Right. So one of two things is going to happen. Either the Gibeonites are going to be influenced by Jewish worship, or the Jews are going to be influenced by the Gibeonite worship. Well, it's going to be one or the other. So
what we go ahead and read, they mixed it up, got a little bit of both in each.
Actually, as far as the Gibeonites are concerned, from everything I could tell, it looks like the Gibeonites are the ones that are swayed into worshiping Yahweh. They become not a problem. Interesting, at least not in this sense. It'll come up later.
There's an option there that I'm wondering. Had you thought about or wasn't even considered or talked about, there was nothing that would have prevented the Israelites from going back to their God and asking him, putting the proposition, we have sinned, made a compact, you told us to kill these people. What do you believe, God, we should do? They didn't go back and ask him.
We'll revisit that in a few minutes. We'll revisit that in a few minutes, Ron.
In verse 26, it seems there was a conflict within Israel too. Mm-hmm.
People wanted to go ahead and wipe them out.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's the humanity that's speaking there, because that's the way I feel about it.
Well, We'll see if you still hold that view by the end of this morning, but I'll have to pick up the pace to do it. All right, chapter 10. All right. Now it came about when Adonai Zedek, king of Jerusalem, heard that Joshua had captured Ai and had utterly destroyed it, just as he had done to Jericho and its king, so he had done to Ai and its king, and that the inhabitants of Gibeon had made peace with Israel and were within their land, that he feared greatly because Gibeon was a great city, like one of the royal cities, and because it was greater than Ai, and all its men were mighty. Therefore Adonai Zedek, king of Jerusalem, sent word to Hoham, king of Hebron, and the Piram, king of Jarmuth, and the Japhia, king of Lachish, and Debir, king of Eglon, saying, "Come up to me and help me, and let us attack Gibeon, for he has made peace with Joshua and with the sons of Israel." So the five kings of the Amorites, the king of Jerusalem, the king of Hebron, the king of Jarmuth, and the king of Lachish, and the king of Eglon, gathered together and went up, and with all their armies they camped against camped by Gibeon and fought against it. And so we've already got this coalition of Canaanite entities, city-states, and kingdoms that have banded together against the Jews, the Israelites. Right. But now a subset of this Canaanite group says, we got to take care of these Gibeonites. Right? And they've got a problem. All right? This is bigger than just the Israelite problem. Not only do they have this invading horde of genocidal Jews that have already taken out a really significant city with Jericho, and then a great city with Jericho, a significant city with Ai, and now they've got defectors. It's not hard to follow their logic here. From their perspective, you can see how this can't be allowed to be continued. Gibeon was in its own right a powerful city-state. From a secular perspective, they would have seemed like good allies to have on the Canaanite side. So the loss of them to the Israelites is a significant blow to their own defensive capabilities. What happens if other cities try and do the same thing? Now, of course, this is looking from the Canaanite perspective and not from the Israelite perspective, who's once bitten, twice shy. I suspect that the same ploy wouldn't have worked a second time. Right. But they needed to make an example out of Gibeon to show the other Canaanites defecting is not an option. It's not going to save you if you go over to the bad guys. Right. They had to do this. Right. This is plugging a hole before the leak gets worse. Verses 6 to 11. Then the men of Gibeon sent word to Joshua to the camp at Gilgal, saying, "Do not abandon your service and come up to us quickly and save us and help us, for all the kings of the Amorites that live in the hill country have assembled against us." So Joshua went up from Gilgal, he and all the people of war with him and all the valiant warriors. The Lord said to Joshua, "Do not fear them, for I have given them into your hands. Not one of them shall stand before you." So Joshua came upon them suddenly by marching all night from Gilgal. And the Lord confounded them before Israel, and he slew them with a great slaughter at Gibeon, and pursued them by way of the ascent of Beth-horon, and struck them as far as Azekah and Makkedah. And as they fled before Israel while they were at the descent of Beth-horon, the Lord threw large stones from heaven on them as far as Azekah, and they died. There were more who died from the hailstones than from those whom the sons of Israel killed with the sword. So we get to this victory here, and we're going to see some of these leadership qualities of Joshua come to the fore, and some of his virtues here that I think are magnificent. The people of Gibeon call on the Israelites to honor this treaty. I mean, it's been a week maybe. And here they are. They need help. And this is opportunity knocking. All they have to do is drag the feet just a little bit, and those Gibeonites won't be a problem. I mean, let's do the prudent thing. If we got a bunch of them coming together, let's make sure all of our people are ready. Make sure that we get up there en masse in a timely fashion, maybe tomorrow. And tomorrow would have been too late. If they did a daylight march, and this was a forced march. This is a distance to go. So all they had to do is just be a little slow, and there wouldn't have been a problem. Right? But here, Joshua is decisive. Right? They managed to pick up, pack up, and go and do an overnight march. Right? So they're there the next morning. You don't move at night.
No,
you don't do it.
No, we didn't fight at night.
No. Like the well, they didn't fight, but they traveled.
They
right? And I've been up the road that they took up from Gilgal up. It's a steep climb. So, but he acts with integrity towards these people who've deceived him. He honors his commitment with literally everything he's got. He doesn't waste a minute. He brings all of their military. And as he does this, he also shows some real audacity. Right? He takes them further, faster than anyone expects them to be able to do, so that they can surprise the Amorites the next morning. Right? And here we have a map that shows you a little bit of that route of what's going to happen that next day. They come up from Gilgal going west there to Gibeon, and then they end up breaking up as they chase them down a couple of different routes. By the way, Ron, not honoring the covenants would have been a bad idea. Would you mind reading 2 Samuel 21, verses 1 and 2? Second Samuel 21. One and two. So here, and I'm pulling an excerpt out that's almost 500 years later. All right. Saul broke this almost 500-year-old covenant with the Gibeonites. And he did this with good intentions. God said, clear out the land, and by golly, he's going to clear out the rest of them. All right, let's clean it out. And, but in doing that, he not only broke this covenant, but he brought punishment on Israel that David ends up dealing with. Right? He's got 3 years of famine because of Saul's actions. And what ends up happening, and we see this in the rest of the passage, but it's seen in most strongly in verse 6. Let 7 men from his sons be given to us, and we will hang them before the Lord in Gibeah of Saul, the chosen of the Lord. And the king said, I will give them. That's how the famine gets brought to an end. Saul was trying to bring an end to the Gibeonites, and so Saul's family was brought to an end. His own family line was cut off because he tried to get rid of the Gibeonites. So it would have been a really bad idea.
Mm-hmm. And he did. Well, if he went back, like I was trying to talk him into doing, if he went back and pleaded his case with the Lord to cancel that treaty, then
bad idea.
He would not have given that victory. Because so, it was the enemy people that they made a pact with, set up the other bunch for the ambush. Mm-hmm.
So this is an opportunity, but not an opportunity to get rid of the Gibeonites. It's an opportunity to get rid of five opponents at once. And that's what they do. God gives them the battle. They win the military side, and then God goes and kills off a bunch more of them with hail. Right? And in the insurance industry, what do they call that? An act of God. Right? Because of stuff like this. This is something that nobody can control. Right? This is God working. And so everybody around, all the Canaanites, they can tell what's going on. The God of the Jews is wiping them out. Verses 12 to 15, then Joshua spoke to the Lord in the day when the Lord delivered up the Amorites before the sons of Israel, and he said in the sight of Israel, O sun, stand at Gibeon, O moon in the valley of Aijalon. So the sun stood still and the moon stopped until the nation avenged themselves of their enemies. Is it not written in the book of Jeshar? And the sun stopped in the middle of the day, in the middle of the sky, and did not hasten to go down for about a whole day. There was no day like that before or after it when the Lord listened to the voice of a man, for the Lord fought for Israel. Then Joshua and all Israel with him returned to the camp at Gilgal. So this is set up literally. This is a flashback. This goes back to what happened before the battle. And we have this, it's presented in poetry, but this seems to be a prayer request of Joshua to God. To give them a long day. Give them enough time to finish the job right. Right. This is a unique miracle. God answered Joshua's request. He gives him an extra day of sunlight. Right. And of course, there is no end of commentary on this. Well, did God physically, are we talking about the world stopping its rotation, or you know what? I'm not gonna mess with it one way or the other, because even the commentary I was reading had about half a dozen different variations that have been presented, and even he was like, you know, I think let's focus on the uniqueness of this day, and even the way it's written up here. The uniqueness of the day isn't focused on the miracle itself. It's focused on the fact that God did that at man's request. And we read Paul talk about faith that moves mountains. How about faith that changes time? Joshua asks, I don't know anywhere else in Scripture where there's a bigger thing asked for. And God gives it to him. So again, throughout the book of Joshua, we see this play back and forth. All right, there's Moses, and there's Joshua. And God is with Joshua just as much as he was with Moses.
What is that book of Joshua that you're talking about?
Another history book that we don't have. We don't have it. All right. Now, because of time, we're going to skip these next few verses, the rest of the 10, because all it is, it's this series of victory after victory after victory after victory. But what we see as we go through the rest of the chapter of 10, we get these kings of these five cities. As they're fleeing, they hide. All right? And apparently you can run, but you can't hide. All right? Because they hide in this cave, and Joshua finds out. He says, just put a cork in that bottle. Roll the stone in, cover them up, leave a couple guards, and we're going to keep going because we've got a victory to finish. So they finish wiping out these armies, and they come back. They pull the cork out of the bottle again. They bring out the kings, and they execute them. And even as he does this, Joshua turns these kings over to his battle commanders, to his war leaders. And he lets the war leaders show their subjugation of the kings. Says, you know, God's with you. God is going to give you, he gave you this victory, he is going to give you other victories. Don't be afraid. So here's Joshua, who doesn't step forward and say, I did this. He lets his commanders have that. He says, and he encourages them. He doesn't need to build himself up. God's already doing plenty of that for him already. So, and do this, when they hang these five kings, they also cut them down at the end of the evening, right, when the sun goes down. Right, in doing that, they're keeping the law that God laid out in Deuteronomy 21. Anyone that's put to death, don't let them hang past sunset. So he, even in how they handle, how they treat their enemies, they're doing it completely in accordance with Deuteronomy, with the law. Same thing that they did with the king of Ai. Right. And we get to the end of this string of victories. Right. And we see that all of this is, we see Joshua's obedience to God's command. He's wiping them out. We see that God is giving these victories to Joshua. Remember, the beginning of the passage starts with they gathered together as a coalition against the Israelites. They were banded together. And we get to the end of this section, and Joshua is still defeating them one at a time. He gets them piecemeal, right? Nice, manageable chunks. And he's winning battle after battle after battle. Even though they intended to be one big mass against Israel, they can't do it because God's against them. But God is doing the work. And if there's any single take-home point from this lesson, it's keep our word. Right? To honor our commitments, even, and maybe I should say especially, those commitments that were ill-advised. Right? Keeping our promises is not something we should only do when it's convenient. It means doing it when it's difficult. Right? And God is a God of faithfulness. He always keeps his word. And I mean, that's so much of what it is to be Christians hangs on the fact that God keeps his word. So when we're faithful, we reflect his faithfulness. If there were a second point this morning, it'd be really be very, very careful which commitments you make. Don't make rash, hasty promises, because you really need to keep the promises you make, whether they were rash or not. So thank you. You're dismissed.